Welcome to Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. My guest is emergency room doctor Michael Murphy. Dr. Murphy is associated with the Peninsula Regional Medical Center in Salisbury. Mike, welcome to Delmarva Today. I really appreciate your joining me.
I'm glad to be here.
Mike, when you and I talked in early April, you mentioned that the pandemic should crest in our area around the end of the month or in early May. At that time, you agreed to come back on Delmarva Today and update us on the progress of the virus in this area. It is now May 6. Could you tell us where we are in the growth of the pandemic in Salisbury and Wicomico area? Has the growth of the pandemic leveled off or flattening in our area, as the New York Times says in another article on May 4? Are Salisbury and Wicomico County hotspots now for the spread of COVID-19?
Yeah, Hal, I think the area is still pretty hot. We are increasing our cases on a daily basis. We haven't quite plateaued. And so we're still seeing active cases coming into the emergency department at PRMC, and we're still admitting patients that have COVID. We also, some things that are sort of skewing some of our numbers, there were 2,000 tests administered over the weekend, mostly to workers and relatives at the local meatpacking plants. And so those numbers are going to start to come back in and probably skew the data a little bit higher. But we remain, because of the rural areas you mentioned, we remain a little hotter than the larger cities. Our peak is coming a little later.
It was noted in these New York Times pieces that I read that nursing homes and meatpacking plants and areas where people work closely together are contributing to this growth. Is that your understanding, Michael?
Certainly the meatpacking plants are contributing and are part of our screening questions when people present to the hospital. I think the nursing homes, they're doing a much better job. I think especially the local nursing homes are aware of the issues regarding transmission of the virus and are doing their best to keep people quarantined if they're exhibiting any symptoms and keeping them away from their other residents. So I think my sense is that the local nursing homes are doing a good job with that. The meatpacking plants are doing their best, but you have a lot of people working in very close environments, and so they are a source for transmission.
How has your workload changed, Michael, as a result of any increase?
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny. The number of people that are presenting to the emergency department is down dramatically, and it's something that's been seen nationwide. People are just staying away from the hospital, except for the very sick patients or patients who are concerned they may have COVID. And so we're seeing a lot more COVID patients, and a lot more COVID patients who are very sick. But in general, we're seeing fewer patients presenting to the hospital.
Are people afraid to come to the emergency room, Mike?
It's hard to say with 100% certainty. I think that's the sense you get. I mean, certainly if you listen to the media, that is what is being sort of cast as the reason. You can't say for sure why people are staying away, but it would make sense that people have a sense that the hospital is where COVID is. No matter what happens to me, I don't want to go to the hospital. So it's a guess, I think, if anybody tells you that that's what's happening, because nobody's done a survey or asked a question. But I think that's probably right. I don't know if there's any way to try to reassure people that we're doing everything we can to keep COVID patients away from patients who don't have COVID but who still have emergencies, and who people who have emergencies should still be coming to the hospital. You know, the message for the beginning of this was don't come to the hospital unless it's you know, a real significant problem. And I think people have taken that to an extreme. And I'm just concerned that people aren't coming when they really need to come. And I just wanted to try to emphasize to people that we're still there for non-COVID emergencies.
You mentioned testing, Michael. What is the current situation with testing?
Right now, I know that the local LabCorp is doing testing. The hospital is testing people who present to the hospital with symptoms or close contacts. I don't have a lot of information in terms of what you have to do to get the test at LabCorp. I think probably you just get a prescription from your physician. The tests at LabCorp are taking several days. If you come to the hospital, there are some rapid tests that are being used, meaning they're generally back within about an hour. Those are given or administered to the sickest patients, patients that are either going to the operating room for surgery immediately, those who have to go for dialysis immediately, those who are headed to the intensive care unit. Those patients are getting a rapid test. Most patients who present to the hospital with symptoms are getting the test that goes to the State Department of Health, and that's still taking 2 or 3 days to come back.
What's the difference between these tests?
I don't know that I can answer that with a lot of certainty. I know that the rapid test that we're using is the test that people have read about from Abbott. And it's just a matter of the reagent and the machine that you're using. It's on site. The rate limiting step is the amount of chemical that you have to add to the swab. So a swab is taken from the nose. You dip that swab in this chemical, and then the machine runs the chemical through an analyzer to see if coronavirus is present. And so the rate limiting step is generally the presence of that chemical. We just don't have enough of it to do all these rapid tests.
So the method of the test remains the same. It's basically the nose swab. Are there other kinds of tests?
Not currently, to see if someone actually acutely has the disease.
And so any lag in time is due to the processing of the test.
Right.
Yeah. Has the accuracy rate changed at all?
Certainly, since the last time we've spoken, it's become a much more accurate test, in the high 90% area in terms of accuracy.
That's national. That's nationwide. Is that global as well?
I don't know about the global. Yeah. I'm not sure about that. But I think nationally, the tests that people are using have become much more accurate than the last time we spoke.
Michael, what's the status of antibody testing? What's going on with that now?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's not as straightforward as we'd like it to be. In fact, I just got an email maybe 5 minutes before this call about the ability to have antibody testing. It's a little more complicated than just going in and having your blood drawn. The current test that they have for antibody testing is not really going to be very helpful in telling us whether a person has had this disease. Right now, the test is simply like a light switch that you turn off or on. There are antibodies present or there are not antibodies present. The problem with the way that they're currently doing the test is that it cross-reacts with a lot of viruses that aren't COVID. This COVID virus is part of the coronavirus, which everybody's heard of, but the coronavirus is a family of viruses that can infect both humans and animals. And there are several versions of the coronavirus that infect humans. And so if you have had an infection with a coronavirus, any coronavirus in the past, the current test will show up as positive. And it's not specific to COVID itself. And so it's not being utilized as a way to tell if people have had COVID.
So knowing whether the antibodies are going to be effective against COVID-19 is something that remains in doubt. Is that what you're saying?
Based on that test, they're working on what's called a more quantitative test. You have qualitative testing and quantitative testing. Qualitative is simply, like we said, the light switch flips on or off that the antibodies are present. A quantitative test can tell you specifically what kind of antibodies and how many of those are present. And so once we have that test, which isn't available yet, we'll be able to tell. Currently, the blood bank is taking plasma from people who have had COVID, but they're not utilizing this antibody test to figure that out. You have to have proof for them that you were positive for COVID, and then you have to have had 2 weeks of convalescence, 2 weeks of recovery from the disease. and then they'll try to utilize your plasma. But they're not doing antibody testing for that.
Yeah. Let me get a little bit into the weeds here, Michael, and ask you a very, very remedial question. What is a virus?
Okay. A virus is a single cell organism that will invade your body and utilize your own cells to reproduce its own RNA, meaning the genetic material of the virus itself. Your body recognizes it as a foreign invader and responds with an immune response.
Is a virus something that is alive? The reason I ask that, Michael, is that I have heard in some reports of the looking for a serum that will kill this virus. And when we talk about killing something, we think of something that is alive, or maybe this is just a way of talking about getting rid of the virus.
It's probably that. I mean, is it alive in the sense that it has genetic material that makes up the cell and has a purpose, which is reproduction of that virus itself? So in that sense, it's a living organism. And you want to try to kill that. You want to stop the process of its reproduction, essentially, is what you're trying to do. And so I guess from that sense, you could consider it a living organism.
Let me get a little bit, if I can, into the medical side of COVID-19, this disease. What does COVID-19 do to the human body? What happens in the body?
Well, as with any most respiratory viruses, you're going to breathe in or bring that virus into your body, whether it's on your hands, you touch your face and it comes in, somebody coughs and you breathe in the droplets that are produced from that cough, and it gets into your lungs. Once it gets into your lungs, it grabs a hold of the cells in the lungs and gets pulled into the body. And from there, it starts to reproduce. And as it reproduces, it spills into the bloodstream and it goes to other organs. And the coronavirus has been pretty vigorous, affecting multiple organs. The virus itself then triggers your immune response. And in some people, the ones that we're seeing that are very sick, the body almost overreacts and produces a number of chemicals to try to fight the virus. And that little bit of overreaction, I guess it's not a little bit, it's a lot of overreaction, can cause a cascade of events that will lead to the lungs filling up with fluid, the bloodstream, blood clots can form, kidneys can become affected, the liver can become affected, and essentially you get what's called multi-system organ failure, and people can die from that.
This sounds like a very nasty disease.
It can be. It can be.
Yeah, you mentioned the blood thickens. And what is the danger of the blood clots? Are they susceptible to moving? And then what happens?
So yeah, the biggest issue with the blood clotting is that the clots can get into the kidneys. The clots, if they form in the legs, if they get big enough, they can break off and get into the lungs, and that can stop your heart. Smaller clots can cause heart attack. It can cause stroke. So yeah, the blood clots are a very serious problem with this.
Let me ask about the lungs. What does it mean, Michael, to be intubated?
So to be intubated is when they put the breathing tube into the lungs. They sedate you so that the machine is essentially breathing for you.
So am I in? I read this, I believe, that patients, when they are intubated, are basically in a coma or are placed in a coma. What does that mean?
So it's a medically induced coma, and essentially you're giving patients medication so that they are sedated and sleeping for a number of reasons. A, you don't want them to have to remember it's a pretty traumatic thing to be in an intensive care unit with the ventilator on. And B, to make it easier for them to tolerate the ventilator. As you can imagine, something in the back of your throat, it's going to make you gag, it's going to make you cough and choke. And when you do that, you're fighting the work of the ventilator. It can affect your lungs' ability to process oxygen and the other gases.
The intubation is obviously incredibly important, but the rate of survival of patients who are intubated, who reach that level, is fairly low. Has that rate changed over time at all, Michael?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, it's still a very low number. And I think that's a reflection of how sick you have to be to be intubated, to be placed on a ventilator. But once you get to that point, you know, it's a full court press and physicians are doing everything they can to save you. But if you are at that point, the survival rate of people who go on the ventilator is still quite low.
Michael, you mentioned the kidneys and you mentioned lungs. For survivors of this disease and this process of treatment, what are the residual issues that survivors face?
We're still not 100% clear on those because this is still such a new disease. I think it should be pointed out that well over 80% of people who get this disease have very minimal to no symptoms. It's a small percentage of people that are going to be sick enough to come to the hospital, and even smaller percentage who end up on the ventilator. So for a great majority of people who have this, it's going to be like having a severe cold. But for the people who are admitted to the hospital, there can be a number of complications, the most severe of which could be chronic issues with the lungs. Once the lungs get inflamed and have this problem with what's called ARDS, which is the lungs just get very heavy and thick with fluid, and that's one of the side effects of this sort of immune response to the lungs. Those folks will have some chronic lung issues related to that. People who have had blood clots will have to be on blood thinners for some time. I'm not sure how the kidney issues are working out. Some people are having problems with the virus affecting their kidney function and are requiring dialysis. Whether that's going to end up being long-term or a short-term situation until the virus is cleared is 100% known.
The blood clots, are blood thinners the primary treatment for that, I would assume? And are they effective at this point in a patient's survival, long-term survival?
Certainly, if somebody's coming in with blood clots, yeah, the blood thinner is the treatment for that, and it's as effective as any other treatment. The big thing with the blood clot is when you give a blood thinner, you're not necessarily breaking down the clot that's there. You're trying to get it to not expand or become any bigger. And so the blood thinner itself is to try to prevent the formation of further clots and to prevent the, say, if you had a clot in your leg, that clot getting bigger and then breaking off and going to the lungs and killing you.
Well, hydroxychloroquine is mentioned now, and it is debunked, I know, but it just won't go away. What is going on, Michael, with hydroxychloroquine? What is it, and why are people persisting to kind of say, well, it might work on COVID-19?
So hydroxychloroquine is a medication that is used usually for prophylaxis for malaria or treatment of malaria. It's a medication that its mechanism of action is to prevent invading viruses or bacteria from getting into a cell. So it prevents that sort of latching on and response to the body to bring that virus or malaria into the cell. And so there was some hope that hydroxychloroquine could work for this. There were some early studies out of Italy that seemed to show some promise that were mentioned as maybe promising. Every subsequent study, just, and this is strictly from a scientific standpoint, every subsequent study of hydroxychloroquine has shown that it is not effective for the treatment of COVID-19 acutely. And we've been trying to utilize this at PRMC. I mean, certainly if we had anything that we thought would be effective or be helpful, we were trying it. So we've been trying every medication we can. But just speaking strictly scientifically, there has not been a single study of merit that shows that hydroxychloroquine is effective. I think it continues to show up for a variety of reasons. I think there might be some political reasons for it. But strictly scientifically, there hasn't been a study of merit that shows that it's effective for COVID.
And it's really strange to even have to say this, but it is crucially important that people do not ingest pesticides and other types of poisons into their system.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. I think avoiding any kind of ingestions of say bleach or household cleaners or pesticides is not going to be helpful for this.
Yeah, any disinfectant. In fact, right. It will be a lot less than helpful.
And certainly external use of soap and cleansers is always great. Wash your hands is the biggest thing with this. Wash your hands, keep surface areas clean. You can utilize those for that, absolutely. But yeah, not for internal use.
Michael, somewhat, if my count is right, there are about 30 states that are either opening their society or are considering opening their society. Are we any way, the governor, our governor is, I think, extremely cautious in this, and I think rightly so. How do you feel about these states opening? And do you have any sense of what the results might be?
Well, first of all, Governor Hogan should be commended for the way he's handled this. I think as far as the path that Maryland has taken, yeah, he's done an excellent job, and he's provided tremendous support to the medical community. You know, the procurement of 500,000 tests that are able to be used across the state's been great. As I understand it, Ocean City is talking about opening up this weekend. I think realistically, anytime you do things, you have to weigh the risks and the benefits. And I'm speaking specifically, medically speaking, anytime you do things, whether you're having your appendix taken out, whether you're having a procedure done, whether you're taking a medication, you weigh the risks and you weigh the benefits. And there will be benefits to reopening the economy sooner. Certainly when you look at how high the unemployment rate is, businesses closing, people can't afford to be out of work. And I think I agree with all of those things.
Absolutely.
You have to get the economy going again, but people have to understand that there's a risk to that. And the risk is going to be that more people will get this disease and people will die from it. And what people have to ask is that risk of more people getting sick worth the benefit of reopening the economy? I'm not an economist, and so I can't really comment on how effective it's going to be to open sooner. My sense would be that it's more effective to the economy to open sooner. We just need to do it the right way and try to minimize risk. You know, people who are saying that only people over the age of 70, only people over the age of 60 are getting this and having a serious illness. I would tell you from a personal experience, I've seen people as young as in their 20s get this and have to be intubated. And so it can affect anybody. Certainly the elderly and those with chronic medical issues are more likely to get the disease. We have to decide as a society what level of risk we're comfortable with. It may be that we slowly reopen as a society, or even maybe a little quicker, and tell people, hey, if you're a diabetic, if you have high blood pressure, if you're obese, if you have chronic lung disease, you need to continue to self-quarantine and stay away from people, but the rest of society is going to try to move forward. I guess if the governor has a plan, then that's the one we're going to follow, but I think it's difficult to say that we're going to be able to do well as a society with continued complete shutdown. So again, it's all about weighing those risks and benefits.
Well, let me come back to Salisbury and your work there. Are you expecting a spike in the number of cases that you are receiving now? And how do you think you will respond if there is an increase? And that's a way of asking, again, do you have all of the equipment that you need to do your job? And if there is a spike, do you have what you need in order to respond to that?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I've been tremendously impressed with at PRMC is the importance of the safety of their employees. The administrators there have done a great job procuring the protective equipment, making sure it's distributed and making sure everybody has what they need. So I think if there is continued need for the utilization of the PPE, we have enough to use at this time. I don't see that being an issue. It hasn't been an issue in the entire time. PRMC has really gone out of their way to make sure that we have the equipment we need. And so I have no concerns that that's going to be an issue moving forward.
How are you feeling, Mike? Are you, you had said the last time we talked that you were made for this, that this kind of work is what you do. And of course we can mourn those who have died, and that's a serious tragedy. But I think we're fortunate that we have you and that we have people like you who see this as a calling.
Well, I appreciate that. I think it can be difficult. I think it's more difficult when you see some of the younger patients that are affected. Certainly every life is important, but there's a level of difficulty with that. But like we talked about last time, it's sort of what we're built for. It's what we do. But I think we're doing okay. And like I said, we have good support from the administrative staff at the hospital. There's counseling that's offered if employees want that or need to talk to somebody. And so I think as a group, we're doing well. I have to say individually, I appreciate the outpouring of support that people have given us. I'm a little uncomfortable with it just because of what we talked about. This is sort of what we do. I treated someone who worked in a grocery store the other day. And to be honest, I think the people that are handling food and making sure that we are all able to eat every day are probably bigger heroes than we are because they didn't ask for this and this isn't what they were built for. So my heart and thanks go out to people who are ensuring that we have food to eat and are safe on the streets. That's just my feeling about it.
Thank you, Michael. Last time we talked, you gave me an indication of when you thought the virus might peak in Salisbury, Wicomico area. Are you ready to give me another one?
I think we're sort of in that range now, and it will really depend on when we reopen. If we reopen, and we may see another peak. There hasn't been a large enough group of people who have been infected that we can prevent a secondary spread. I don't think. I think right now we're in the middle of a peak. There may be another one.
I wondered if you would be willing to come back again in another month and update us again on your work and on the work of the hospital in combating this virus.
Anytime, Hal. Just let me know when.
I will certainly be back in touch with you. Thank you very much, Mike, for joining me today. And I want to thank all of you for listening to Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.